Okay, we are welcome to Westminster Confession of Faith. We're marching along through this great document. We're on week 9, chapter 9. And as always, we've got copies of the confession up here and an outline. Everything on the outline's up here. But if you want a closer view of it, then we've got a paper copy for you to look at. And you can take notes on it as well. Well, this topic this week is on the title is Free Will. And we're moving from topics specifically about God now to this interaction between God and man. And it's interesting that they gave a whole chapter to this topic of free will. Now, before we jump into it, I want to say that when people talk about this question, does man have free will? That's typically approached from a philosophical standpoint, very, very heady. But that's not what this is all about. I don't want you to encourage you to think about this and approach it not from a philosophical standpoint, although there is, there is a philosophical aspect to it. But this is really a spiritual chapter or psychological. It's really about how we're made. That's what this chapter is. It's not really trying to answer the big philosophical questions of does man have free will and free choice and all of those. That's answered in the or addressed in the confession and other parts. But this is really about who are we? How do I understand who I am? How am I made? So we're going to kind of pick up a little bit on something we talked about last week, which was how is man made? Is the three parts or the two parts to man? Our minds, the spirit, soul, and body, and how does all that work? So I want to encourage you just to come at this from the standpoint of or be thinking in your own minds. This is really an answer to the question: how has God made me? Okay. This is a biblical understanding of the Bible tells me how to understand myself. And, Calvin pointed this out. It's the one thing most people know about Calvin's Institutes, and it's really the most important thing. So it's good, because if you know one thing about Calvin and his Institutes, this is the thing to know. He starts out this great treatise on theology by saying, any true knowledge of ourselves leads to true knowledge of God. And any true knowledge of God leads to true knowledge of ourselves. Well, that sounds very philosophical. What does he mean? Well, I think he didn't say this, but I think what he means is we find ourselves when we find God. And the only way for us to really understand who we are, since it's in him that we live and move and have our being, we can't really understand ourselves apart from him. And part of what becoming a Christian is coming to it's coming out of the fog, it's coming out of the lies, not just of the world, but coming out of the fog of into clear understanding of who we are. John Piper makes the same point, I think, in his book, Desiring God. And he says, the first question of the Shorter Catechism, a better way to say it, is to say, what is the chief end of man? It's man's chief end is to glorify God by enjoying him forever. So in other words, glorifying God and enjoying him are the same thing. So when we come into right relationship with God, when we're saved and we come into harmony with him, that's the beginning of us coming into becoming healed and brought out of all the darkness, and that includes darkness about ourselves. So this chapter is really talking about the will. It's really helping us to understand how we're made, specifically in this aspect of what the Bible calls our will. Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Now, this first paragraph just simply tells us what our will is. What is our will? So it says this: God has endued the will of man with that natural liberty that it is neither forced nor by any absolute necessity of nature determined to good or evil. So what is our will? Well, God has created us with the capacity to choose. Okay? We're not robots. And that ability deep down within us is called our will. It's the place where we truly understand things. One theologian says it's the seat or the home of all of our cognitive ability, our emotions, and our choices. So it's not just where we make choices, but if you think about the will is down, it's the very core of who we are. It's very analogous to the Bible's use of the term the heart. Okay? It's our heart. It's not just where we make choices, but it includes where we make choices. It's the very bottom of who we are. It's the deep seat of the emotions, the deep seat of the person. It's where we make choices and where we turn towards God or where we turn away from God. It's where we know Him. Now, this is a definition of the heart, but I think it could equally be applied to a definition of the will. Let me read this to you. It's the best definition I've found. I've shared it in here before. It says, the heart is the dwelling place where I am, where I live. The heart is the place to which I withdraw. The heart is our hidden center beyond the grasp of human reason. Only the Spirit of God can fathom the human heart and know it fully. The heart is the place of decision, deeper than our psychic drives. It is the place of truth, where we choose life or death. It is the place of encounter. Excuse me. So, again, it's analogous to the heart. Sorry, I got a little tickle in my throat. Sorry. So when we talk about the will, lots of times when you say the heart, a lot of people think, well, that's just where our emotions are. When we talk about the will, some people think, well, that's just where we decide things or volitionally choose things. And the reality is, it's the deep core of our being where all of those things are. Okay, our wills. It's where, and God made us with this amazing capacity. It's an amazing thing that we have this ability within us. He gave us the power to choose. If you think about that, just think about how we're made. Okay, it's just this. It's an amazing capacity within us. We have a conscience. That's an amazing thing. We have a mind. That's an amazing thing. But this is different from each of those. Our will is just that capacity to turn towards something, to accept something, to reject something, to say yes or to say no to something. It's the deep part of who we are. All right. So that's what the will is. Okay. So it's the will is this home, the home of all of our cognitive, emotional, and volitional ability. All right. So now what the confession does is says, okay, if that's what the will is, if that's who we are, if that's how we're made, how does this work itself out in our lives spiritually? What happens to our will? How does our will play itself out? And there are four stages. I've shared these with you before. Well, let me throw this up here first. This is the graph we showed last week, the three parts to who we are. Remember I said there's a debate whether man is made into two parts or three parts, with the dipartite and tripartite views of man. And there's scriptures that point to both. There's some say that, well, there's an outward part and an inward part. And then there are other scriptures that say, you know, like in the benediction I typically use now, may your spirit, soul, and body be kept sound and blameless. So there's different views. Most theologians will say, by the way, that there's an outward man and an inner man. But within the inner man, that's subdivided into different aspects. Okay, that's probably the best answer. But my point is that spirit, soul, and body, mind, emotion, and volition. That's really, your will encompasses all of those things, okay? So, what happens, we're going to go through the rest of the paragraphs go through these four successive stages, spiritual stages of the will. And the first is, what kind of will did Adam and Eve have? What kind of will did they have in the Garden of Eden? And here's the answer. Man, in his state of innocency, had freedom and power to will and to do that which was good and well-pleasing to God, but yet mutably, so that he might fall into sin. So this is what the confession or theologians call man was created with a will that was posse peccare. It was able to sin. Okay? So Adam and Eve had this, they had this will, this capacity, this ability within them, this capacity to choose, and they were not limited in that choice. They could choose to live with God, but they could also choose to walk away. Okay, they could choose to continue to live in life in harmony with Him, or they could choose to walk away. Now, one of the questions that comes up sometimes when people talk about this is that would Adam and Eve have had to live that way forever? And you know, it's a speculative question, but it is a question that's out there, and I guess it's worth answering. So I put it on there. I guess it's worth answering. But most theologians will say, you know, that think about this thing, they'd say, you know, that probably the period of time that Adam and Eve were put in the garden that said, don't eat of this tree, that was probably a temporary time. That if they had come through that temptation and not sinned, then God would have said, okay, and they moved them into a state where they could not have sinned anymore. They couldn't have made that sinful choice anymore. In other words, God probably, let's say Adam and Eve didn't sin for hundreds of years, and they started having children, and the earth went on for a long time with multiple generations, and they still had not sinned. Would they still have that possibility 300 years after they were created to sin and turn away from God? Most theologians say no. Why do they say that? Well, they say a couple of things. First of all, in glory, that's not, you know, in heaven, that's sort of the ideal of where God is taking us, and that's probably where he would have taken them. They would have come through the temptation, passed the temptation stage, and then moved into a ratification where that choice was taken away from them. A second reason is when you look at Jesus, who was the second Adam, you see this pattern that he came, that he was tempted, but he came through the temptation. He didn't live in that immense time of temptation. You know, he went through that 40 days of temptation in the wilderness, and then that temptation was pulled back, and he came through the testing as the second Adam, and then went on to live his life. And they say, well, that's probably what would have happened to the first Adam as well. We don't know, answering a speculative question, but I thought somebody might ask it, so I just went ahead and answered it. Okay. So the first stage is God gives us this capacity. He gave us this capacity to choose Him. And at first, we could use that capacity to choose Him or to choose to turn away from Him. That's the posse peccare. Okay, a little bit. Then things get complicated. Well, what happened to our wills when we sinned, when we fell? That moves into a different stage. Now, our sin, our will is non posse, non peccare. We're not able not to sin. In other words, it's a double negative there. So now it leaves us in that position of a broken will can only choose to run away from God. So this is what it says. Man in his, paragraph 3. Man by his fall into a state of sin has wholly lost all ability of will to any spiritual good accompanying salvation. So as a natural man, being altogether averse from that good and dead in sin, is not able by his own strength to convert himself or to prepare himself thereunto. Okay? So God created us with this will, and we sinned. And sin is deadly to us. Sin is deadly. And this is true. It was true of Adam and Eve, and it's true of us. Sin is deadly to us. The first thing sin does is sin brings guilt. Okay? It kills our innocence. It destroys our innocence. We were made for purity. We were made for holiness. We were made to walk in the ways of God, to walk that path, to live in perfect harmony with God and ourselves and others and nature. And when we sin, we come under that sentence of guilt, that accusation of guilt. Okay, it takes away. So the first thing sin does is it destroys our innocence. The second thing it does is it destroys our ideals. We lose that distinction between good and evil. Our ethics get turned upside down. Okay, this is why when we don't know God, we call evil good and good evil. We get it mixed up. We say this is truth. We call error truth and falsehood truth, and we call truth error. We call the light dark and the dark light. We get it mixed up because we lose our sense. Because when we're out of relationship with God, we lose our point of reference. We lose that true north. So we don't know what's right and what's wrong. I mean, we lose it. We do internally. We all have a sense of that. We know that we're sinning, but we get so twisted that we have a hard time telling the difference. We lose the ideals that we need to live. And ultimately, you know, people that take this to a logical conclusion are going to end up in nihilism. They're going to end up in meaninglessness because they lose their sense of meaning. They when you lose that moral category, when you lose a sense of what's right and wrong, and you realize, okay, if there's not a God and I'm disconnected with Him, there can't be absolute truths. There can't be these meta narratives. There can't be truth claims, and there's no absolute truth, and which means I don't have a soul, and there's no reason to be here, and I can't make sense of anything. Nothing matters. Nothing means anything. I'm just a blob, and you're just a blob. And so there's no distinction between this blob's actions and that blob's actions, and that's just where we end up. We end up in nihilism. The third thing that sin does, though, is it kills our wills. Our wills are damaged and killed, not just damaged, but killed. Our wills become crippled. We still have this capacity, but it's completely, we still have that power rather, but it's a power that we can't harness and use in the right way. Okay, so our will is how we decide what we're going to be oriented towards. And we can't orient ourselves towards God anymore. Our choices get messed up. We've misused our wills, and therefore that will gets damaged. Okay, it becomes sin becomes what Augustine called a cruel necessity. Because we sin, and then we get drawn into that sin. Every time we sin, Augustine said, it's like we're making a chain, and each sin is just like a link of that chain, and we just keep adding a link to that chain. And what's happening to the chain, though? Well, the chain is used to enslave us. It's to imprison us. Anybody that's seen addictions, or you know, that's a really clear picture of that. So our will is no longer able to choose. Okay, we can only choose sin. We can only go away from God. Our wills are broken. That's what happens to us. Okay, so sin destroys our innocence. It destroys our ideals. It kills our wills, and that's where we're left. So the one thing that God gave us, this place within us where we can orient ourselves to God now, is dead. It's destroyed. That's the bad news. Okay. So it goes on. The next paragraph says, okay, well, what happens, though, when a man or a woman comes to know the Lord? Okay, so paragraph 4 says this. When God converts a sinner and translates him into the state of grace, he frees him from his natural bondage under sin, and by his grace alone enables him freely to will and to do that which is spiritually good. Yet so as by reason of his remaining corruption, he does not perfectly nor only will that which is good, but does always will that which is evil. So there is good news, okay? Sin destroyed our wills. And y'all, this is so important to grasp, okay, as a Christian. Because I don't think a lot of Christians get this point. Okay, I think that we get total depravity. We say, well, I'm a sinner, and I know if there's anything I know about theology as a Presbyterian, I know I'm a big old sinner. I'm a big fat sinner. And that's true. But I want y'all to hear this next paragraph, because this is really important for living the Christian life. I'm not sure we always get this. I'm going to start out by reading you, I read you the paragraph, but let me read you Paul from Ephesians 2. I want you to think about, hear this, and it's a familiar passage, but listen to it as if it's talking about your wills. As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our flesh and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were by nature deserving of wrath. But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive. He made you alive. I might even insert here, he made your will alive again. That will that was killed is now made alive with Christ Jesus while we were dead in transgressions, for it is by grace you've been saved through faith. And I think that's applying not only to our justification, but also to our sanctification. So the good news is that Christ came and freed our wills from sin. Okay? He all those consequences of what sin did to us, go back. Sin destroyed our innocence and left us guilty. Sin destroyed our ideals and sin killed the will. Christ came to redeem all of those. So he came to not just deal with our guilt, and not just to give us our ideals back and show us what's right and wrong, but he also gave us, he came and restored our choice. He gave us our choice back. He restored our wills and freed them so they're not enslaved to sin anymore. Okay, that's the good news. There was a day in history, so Christ came and his dying on the cross broke that power of sin over us. And it was over every aspect of us. Okay, so it brought my mind out of darkness into light. Okay, it changed my ideals, but it also changed my ability to choose. Okay, he restored that. He broke the oppression of our iniquity. Okay, he opened the prisons and said, okay, now you can choose to come out. Now you don't have to choose to run away anymore. And now you don't have to choose to walk in this path over here. He puts our feet back in the path so we're not slaves anymore. This is the freedom, not just from guilt, but freedom from what we call the presence and the power of sin. Okay, so we're not slaves anymore. We're no longer owned by sin. He restored our freedom. I want you to think about that. Just let that sink in. God, Jesus Christ, restored your freedom. And that's good news. And I don't know if any of y'all have, if you've been a Christian for any length of time and struggled with sin and habitual sin and persistent things that don't, you just struggle to get rid of. That's really good news to know God said, you don't have to keep doing that. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean that it's not without difficulty. It doesn't mean that you're going to make that choice once and never go back to sin and you're going to fall back in. You know, it doesn't mean that's not going to happen. But it does mean that sin is no longer a cruel necessity. Does it mean you're going to live a perfect life? No, that's not what we're saying. But we are saying that Christ did free our wills so that he restored to us the power of choice. Okay? That's a huge thing. He lifted that burden of sin off of our shoulders so that we can begin to choose again. We can say yes. Okay? We can begin to orient ourselves towards God again. So we can get up tomorrow morning and say, you know, I really blew it today. You know, I really blew it. And say, you know, God loves me, and I receive that forgiveness, and I receive that cleansing again. But I don't have to stay here. None of us have to stay wherever we are. That's such a beautiful thing. And that God says, no, we're not going to stay here. Not at all. I have great plans for you. I've laid out this path, and I am ready to go with you. And I'm ready to start again. I'm ready to begin again. We don't have to stay where we are. We can't change. And like I've talked to a lot of people, say I can't change, he can't change, she can't change, we can't change. That's a lie from the pit of hell. If you belong to the Lord Jesus Christ, if you're a child of God, Jesus Christ has broken the power of sin over your choices, so that your choices are not going one direction anymore. He's restored that. Now again, do we need help? Yeah. We may need encouragement. We may need understanding. We may need teaching and enlightenment. And we're going to fall and stumble. But we can move forward. Okay? So we can get back on the path. And as we start walking with God, when we become a Christian, that power is broken over our wills, and then a process starts where he begins to call us out and calls us up. He begins to rescue us from that bad choice, okay? So I've said enough about that. Okay? So perfection is not possible. They say that as well. They say when God converts a sinner, he frees him from that natural bondage to sin, but it's never going to be perfect. There's always going to be some point, some remaining sin, of course, and struggle. And there are some Christians, by the way, who latch hold of that truth that we were just talking about, that our wills are broken and your choice is restored. They latch onto it so much, they let the pendulum swing on the other way, and they've said, you know, perfection is possible. I've heard preachers say that they don't sin anymore. That was in the AOG in Pelham, Georgia, Assembly of God Church in Pelham, Georgia. I've heard people say that. Some of you may have heard people say that they don't sin anymore. I asked his wife later, and she differed. She disagreed with him. So perfection is not possible. All right. So this is what we would call now. We are restored to that posse non peccari. We're able not to sin. We don't have to choose to go down that dark path anymore. Okay. That's what a Christian is. Part of what a Christian is. Then lastly, they say, well, what about the will of man in glory and in heaven? Well, this is the final state of man's will, that the will of man is made perfectly and immutably free to good alone in the state of glory only. So eventually, when we get to heaven, our wills will be we will not be able to sin anymore. Where our wills will be, that choice will be fully, that will be fully healed and fully mature, so that we only choose, we're free to choose only that which is good. So the Latin for that is not able to sin. Non posse peccare, not able to sin. And that's, that, again, that's that. There, perfection is possible, but not in this life. Okay? Well, that's all I've got. A little shorter chapter, a little shorter lesson. Anybody got any comments or questions? That's right. Yeah, I was thinking about that. I'm not sure how that would affect. I don't know if y'all can hear the comment that there's the first, what we call first heaven or second heaven or permanent heaven or immediate heaven, you know, between our death and until the resurrection. You know, we're in the presence of the Lord, but our bodies have not yet been resurrected. And how does that affect our wills? You know, our catechism says, believers being raised up in glory shall be openly acknowledged and acquitted in the day of judgment and made perfectly blessed in the full enjoying of God to all eternity. I wouldn't die on this hill, but I think I would say that our wills are perfectly, our wills are perfected at death, and it's not, but the resurrection, there's still this out, you know, our bodies haven't been united to our spirit, so that's what's hanging out there. But I'm not sure how it affects our wills, to be honest with you. But it's not purgatory. You're not in purgatory waiting. I know that.